What Came Next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Nicole Meyer is a mother, educator, and victim survivor of several types of abuse from Australia. Her journey towards justice and healing was a long, arduous one that spanned 15 years and two countries. Amidst it, Nicole was eventually joined by her sisters, who she would find out were victims of her alleged abuser. The highly publicized nature of their legal battle inspired them to participate in the documentary Surviving Malka Lifer, and has propelled Nicole to continue to speak out in Parliament and worldwide. Her mission is to unite and empower survivors, as well as to spread awareness as a means for prevention. The Broken Cycle Media team is so very appreciative of Nicole's time, advocacy, and powerful perspective in these episodes.
The trial ran for 9 weeks, including deliberation. That is quite a long amount of time for a trial to go on for. That second weekend, my sisters and I looked at each other and somehow we all had this feeling that the verdict's coming on Monday. We all wore the same clothes we wore the very first day of trial. We're going to walk in with our heads up high. The media outside was intense. It was like everyone knew that was the day it was going to happen. Everyone felt it in the air. We went in, no phone calls before lunch. Everyone's on absolute edge. What is taking the jury so long? Then at 3 o'clock, I got a phone call from the prosecutor. The verdict's in. All verdicts at 3:45. That little part is the only part that was allowed to be put in the documentary because you're not allowed to film in courts, but they allowed a handheld camera. So you just see our reaction when we got that phone call. And then we all met upstairs in level 4, the prosecutor, the police, the social worker, everyone standing there. We went into the courtroom for verdicts. The courtroom was packed to the rafters. There was not a single seat available. The door was closed. The guard didn't allow anyone to come in and stand. It was pin drop silence. It was the most scariest moment. So much was weighing on this. The judge came in, everyone stands up and bows. The jury came in. Not a single jury member looked at the three of us sitting on the chair, gripping our hands together. And we said, this is not good. I had said, if I get not guilty, you're going to have an ambulance outside to resuscitate me. That's how worried I was that I would get not guilty and the response that my body would have as a result. The judge says a couple of instructions. He said something that I felt really I knew straight away in my heart, in my gut, it's me. There cannot be any emotional responses or you'll be removed from the courtroom or something like that. Like he gave some kind of warning that something might not go well. And I was just like, okay, I know what's coming. He asked the foreman to stand up and he said on charge 1, not guilty, charge 2, not guilty, charge 3, not guilty, until charge 5, not guilty. I think everyone was in shock. The way the courts are set, you have the QC, KC facing the judge, and then you have the barristers facing the room. Because they sit on the other side of the table. And I could see her and she's looking at me and I'm looking at her. And they say, charge 6, guilty. And you could hear the whole courtroom breathe. She got 1 guilty. That's it. She's guilty on something. Then they went through all the way guilty and then a couple not guilties thrown in until charge 27. After all the verdicts were given, Malka Lifer was found guilty on 18 charges. The judge literally thanked the jury for their service. told Michael Eifert to be taken back, and that was it. It was over. The media is scrambling like crazy. My most visual sensory memory of that day is sitting there in utter shock, like I think I forgot to breathe, and watching the journalists in front of me ticking and crossing charge by charge by charge and flipping the page and then doing the same again. For them, it's mechanical. It's a job. It's just an X or a tick. For me, it's my whole life upended. Now I've got this before and after. Everything has just turned upside down for me, but for them, they're going to go outside and do the news. So we walked and we went into this massive lift, and it was the worst lift ride of my life because the whole lift was packed full of everyone in the team, the support people of my siblings, and they talked. I think everything went above my head. I was so dissociated. I was not hearing absolutely anything anyone said to me. Everyone left the room and they left my sisters and I, just three of us alone together. My sisters were literally heartbroken for me. They were collapsing and I couldn't break down. And I said, guys, we need to go outside. It's been half an hour. The media is waiting for us. We've prepared this. We have our statements. We made statements for a bittersweet verdict. We made statements for fully guilty. We made statements for not guilty at all. We've got our portions. We know what we want to say. We've got to be strong. I'm okay. Let's go. And I gave them strength to get up. Let's get outside. Let's hold our heads high. And we walked outside to the most enormous media ready for us to hear our statements. They heard what we said. They asked a bunch of questions. And then we were just left standing there. The media is still following us. They still want to get pictures. And we're just like, we just want to get out of here. It was such an enormous moment. I know it's going to sound odd. And I might soon ask my sisters, like, do they feel, and I know what they'll say, that my not guilty impacted their ability to feel the relief and the closure that they got. It was hard for all of us because we were all feeling for each other. We ended up staying in a hotel for the night together. We had packed bags in the morning knowing that we would spend the night together, whatever happens. It was very hard for me to celebrate. We didn't do any media that night. We said we'll do it the next morning because we started getting overseas media come in during the night and we just had no energy to do it. I went the next day and did a whole bunch of media with one sister. The other sister said she couldn't do any more media. And then the next couple of months, I was in a very broken, probably, I will say, suicidal place. Receiving not guilty on some level felt so shameful, like I didn't do a good enough job or my trauma wasn't seen in the way, my abuse wasn't validated in the way that I needed it to be. A lot of survivors who go through the court system and receive not guilty, that's where it stops. There is no opportunity to give a victim impact statement. And that was, for me, the most hardest thing. There is no mention of me in the sentencing. It's like I have become invisible in the rest of whatever happens going forward. I had months where there were still court processes going on with the plea hearing and the sentencing hearing, direction hearings, where I would attend every single one, but I was not included in any single one. That was excruciatingly painful, which just added more to the pain I was already feeling. August 24th was the day of sentencing. My sisters and I arrived to court. We had no idea what the sentencing would be because the state we're in does not give very high sentences for sex offenders. We knew there were 27 charges. We knew that originally Michael Eifert had come into the country and extradited on 74. We also knew that there was no way to know what a female perpetrator in Australia would get for the crimes that she committed. When we came in, the judge had a long statement to read before he gave the sentencing. Then he began to sentence. We were warned beforehand it would be confusing because he would say amount of years, but the years are not added one on top of the other. The way the sentencing works here is there is a base amount, so let's say 8 or 10 years, and then every charge above that will get 6 months or a year or 2 months. So we shouldn't try and work it all out because the lawyers will have it for us after. So the judge literally listed each charge. So he started at charge 6 and then said for the crime of, and he would mention the crime, and then he would say the years, and he wouldn't quite say how much would be given for that charge. And he went through all the charges, and at the end he said, Michael Eifert, I sentence you to a total of 15 years, including time served. Michael Eifert served 2 years in prison in Israel before she was extradited to Australia. Once she arrived in Australia in 2021, she served another 2 years in prison here in Australia until trial in 2023. So her 4 years time served were taken off her sentence of 15 years. So she has 11 years left to serve, but parole is possible after 8 years. So she is due up for parole 2029. Her sentence does not finish till 2032. It is up to the parole board, however they operate here, to decide when she will be paroled. So it feels very close, but it does not feel far enough based on what she did and how long it took her to come back and face justice, seeing the number 15. In general, in our state of Victoria, I think was like, wow, that's a good number. It was good, but not good enough, because it really isn't enough years for the amount of damage and trauma and abuse that she caused for so many years. I often think how I had the strength to show up again and again through the months that followed the not guilty verdict to all the court processes. What I have come to understand is I lived for so many years with a drive for justice. It's what drove me through the hardest times, through so many challenges, through so many letdowns, through that whole process. And if I suddenly quit because I received not guilty, that was doing such a disservice to myself. So my sense for justice was still so strong that even if it wasn't my own justice, I was trying to feel a collective sense of justice. And I really think as much as it was so painful for me, that strength started to build again. And that set me up to later on be able to take back that power and that strength and start my healing journey loudly and clearly and not being silent and shamed. So by probably late September, early October, when all the court processes are finished, by then I realized I have to start healing. I can sink even lower, and I know my siblings were worried I would never come out of it, or I could shift and do something with my pain and do something with my trauma and do something with my healing. At some point, I realized the only way I'm going to get out of this is to not allow my Khalifa to shut me up again. And I slowly started to think a little bit differently. It wasn't easy. I just realized I'm not going to allow this shame to silence me, because shame is what silenced survivors. I know what happened to me is true. And I know there's so much the courts didn't get to hear, a tremendous amount of abuse they didn't get to hear. And I'm going to start sharing. I literally opened a TikTok account and started putting up stuff. I don't do editing. I don't do anything fancy or aesthetic. That's not me. This is the real me. You like it, you take it, you don't. And I started sharing the story. Bits of pieces that I could share, news articles, newsreels, whatever I could to share. And April 3rd, exactly a year after the verdict, I checked myself into a hotel. My husband understood I needed to be alone that day. And I sat and recorded 7 parts of my victim impact statement that I could not say in court. And that was the most healing thing I've ever done, because I acknowledged this happened to me. It took me 2 hours, and the videos are not more than a couple minutes each. And I shared that online. This is my impact statement. This is what I could not say a year ago. And this is my healing point. And from then on, it just went up and up and up. That was the shift. That was the change. That day was so traumatizing. And once I finished doing that, I felt so much better. And I'd called my husband. I said, I'm coming home. I don't need a second night here, because I felt that shift had happened and I had reclaimed what had been taken from me through the legal process and the lack of justice. I think my first step to advocacy, in a sense, was going online on TikTok, putting words to really difficult stuff that a lot of survivors cannot put words to because they can't, because they don't know how to. And I started receiving messages from people disclosing abuse that they never had before, particularly from older people. I started receiving messages that they felt seen and validated, and finally someone understands them. That really was like, okay, I'm not alone here. My mission is that other survivors don't feel alone and unsupported. I also had an opportunity through those really painful months to have an exclusive interview with a reporter where I was able to share my story, my words. I was invited to attend an event that is quite new in Australia, and I don't know if other countries have it, called National Survivors Day. There was an event in Parliament in our state where a room full of survivors gather together and there's a couple of speakers. It's a day to recognize survivors. And for me to go to that event at that time, the first time, felt like, even though everyone knew me publicly as a survivor, it was the first time I stood in a room and acknowledged to myself, I am a survivor. It was the strangest thing, because having this public image and working publicly for so long to receive justice and our names being in the media all the way from 2017, suddenly in 2023, I'm in a room with other survivors. And I started realizing I'm a survivor, so I can speak out and I can help others and I can heal. I was doing therapy and I was working through a lot in therapy, and I'm very consistent with my therapy because I know how helpful it is for me personally. And more opportunities started to come for me. I got invited to speak at an event. Someone that attended that meeting heard me speak, so they asked me to come to Sydney and do some filming for child safety. So I did a bit of that. And then I was asked to be an ambassador for National Survivors Day in the second year. That was incredible, because now I was a voice on behalf of the day. And I spoke in Parliament. I actually spoke in a room with the Prime Minister and a bunch of other politicians, just me speaking. And it was so interesting, because the current Prime Minister, who's the one that I met when we had tried to get Mark Khalifa back, his party met with us and released a statement saying how important it is for Mark Khalifa to come back, and gave us support before he even became the leading party. So I mentioned that in my conversation. He remembered that as well. So when he got up to speak, he referenced, and it was a really full circle kind of moment to be an ambassador. And then I was asked to speak again, and I started having more speaking arrangements come in. People were interested to hear how I thought about healing and advocacy and prevention. Really, these opportunities, every time they came to me and I chose to attend and speak up, it felt to me so healing, but at the same time, so grateful, because I know there are so many survivors who don't have opportunities, who don't have a voice, who can't have a voice, and even those that are no longer with us. That is something I always keep in mind when I'm doing my advocacy work. I really hold the space internally for so many other survivors who, for various reasons, can't speak up. I think that many survivors are silent survivors. They hold a lot of shame. Often when I give a speech, I'll always say I'm acknowledging silent survivors in this room, because I know there will be some. I think if anyone has the ability to acknowledge in themselves they are a survivor, that is already something I would feel is a humongous step, and I would encourage a person to try and do. But also to find a safe person. Many times people feel like they don't have the ability to go make a report or to share their story, and that's okay. But if you want to share on some level, find a safe person that you can share that information with. Recently, at an event I spoke to, someone came up to me after and said, I was with a friend one time. I shared that I'd been abused, and she went to the bathroom, and I said to myself, oh no, did I say something wrong? She came back and said that she had been abused too. We never know the power of actually sharing to someone that we feel that we can trust. So I think my encouragement is, if you're holding on to something that's happened to you and you want to share it, or you want to talk to someone, then find someone safe in your network, whether it's a friend or a therapist or a sibling or another survivor. It came to be that I started having this really burning passion that I had when I was 18 to study law. And it was so strange, because I was finally in a healthier headspace where I could think future. And I remembered a conversation that on one of those court sessions, we were all in the lift together, probably after the sentencing. And the prosecutor turned around to us and she said, I bet you never want to see the inside of a courtroom again, because this has been the end of a long year where we had spent many days in court. And my sisters both said, no way. And I said, I want to be here every day. That was my instant response, that whatever had happened to me, the trauma I'd gone through, did not stop me from wanting to be able to help survivors from inside the system. So finally, the beginning of 2025, I decided I'm going to give it my best shot. I'm going to apply. I know that because of my upbringing and my schooling and the fact that I didn't do the government required exams, because my school didn't provide that, I will not get into the university I want to. But it's not about the university. It's about doing the degree, getting through it, and working my way up to do something I've wanted to do since I was 18, But that passion only got reignited going through my own process through the court system. And so I started to study, and it's not easy. It will take a long time. And whenever someone says to me, how long? I'm like, I have no idea. Because if I look, I will probably be discouraged. I'm just going to keep going step by step. And I know that I will get there. And I know that I'll have people there in the system already who know me, that if I need guidance or if I need a way to know what to do next in regards to career, I will just keep at it. And I will hopefully get there at some point, but I don't know when that is. But that drive for justice will now come through me helping and providing others receive justice, working within the court system. Throughout the whole process of Marco Leifer coming back to Australia, the courts and any changes or processes that happened along the way, through any events that were happening in our life that connected to the story, we were being filmed. Because we were filmed for 5 years, it felt like it was just part of life. I don't want to say that in the way that we liked it, no, but we just got to a place where we were like, okay, the filming's happening, but we are in our own world. We are going forward with what we need to do. We feel how we feel. And that's what the documentary's power really is. The documentary is called Surviving Marco Leifer, a name that we did not choose, but it's okay. It really encapsulates a journey that is a humongous amount of years and filming into 90 minutes. But it is done really well going through a journey for myself, my sisters, each of us separately, but also united, showing what we went through to get into court, showing how the courts were working, showing how we felt after, the impact of that, and then showing where we all are in life now. It really gives a deep insight into what it feels like to fight for justice. It was at times frustrating, and there were times where I said to the producer, I just can't film today. I don't want to be in camera. By the time we were doing the filming for the documentary, we had really grown in our ability to be assertive and to have boundaries. It wasn't easy, but we learned together to have boundaries. We trauma-informed the producer who was with us. We helped him to know how to deal with us, or how to be more sensitive, or how to be more careful, or what we couldn't do, or what we couldn't say, or what we weren't willing to. So it was kind of a learning process. And we had a great team. So we were able to really get along with each of the people that we were around in the project of making this documentary. In 2024, they called us in and they said, we need you for one day. We need your hair and makeup done. We want to do master interviews. So there's all the fillers. We ask questions and those fillers will be in and amongst the documentary. So you're going to sit in a chair. We've got a studio. We've got the backdrops and equipment that we want. We'll take a couple of moving shots, but each of you need half a day. So we all set that up. It was incredible for me to see. We hadn't done filming much for the whole last year because the trial and all that finished 2023. And to come back in 2024 and feel the energy that I had on that day, and you can see that in the documentary, it was incredible. That for me was such evidence that I had really come out of that dark place I was in, much stronger, more confident. My energy was high. I was feeling good. I was talking about really difficult stuff. Some of those questions were very pointed at me, but it was okay. So it made me feel a lot more confident about what this documentary will show, because it will show the really hard parts, but it will also show the strong parts. Then there was a waiting game. When it's going to come out? Is it going to come out end of 2024, or is it going to come out 2025? Finally, we got the go date that it would be September or October 2025. And I was busy that whole year with a lot of advocacy works and speeches. My sister released a book called In Bad Faith, which she wrote, which is incredible. I went with her to a lot of book events to support her at all the times that she was speaking as well. So it was a very busy year. And then we were told it was going to stream, and it felt amazing, but it also felt surreal. Like, is it really going to happen? Is it really going to happen? We were told that a big festival in Melbourne wants to premiere the documentary. The first premiere was in the beautiful theatre. They got cars to come and pick us up, and there was a little red carpet where we had some pictures. My sisters and I sat, and this was the first time ever that we were watching the documentary on this enormous screen in a packed room of people. It was the most surreal moment. I think we were holding each other's hands most of the documentary. We were cringing sometimes. We were covering our faces because we were embarrassed other times. It was unbelievable. None of us realized how exposed we would feel. And it's not a bad feeling, but it's a feeling that we had to sit with. We had that first premiere and a lot of our family and friends had come to that premiere. So everyone was standing around after and talking until they shoot us out with a ding of a bell because the next show was starting because it's a film festival. So we can't just take up the room for a long time. We went out and had a group dinner together with the producers and a team. All of us were speaking. We met the next day for coffee and we're just like, that was enormous. And we're going to do that all over again on Sunday because the second premiere was on Sunday. We did that in the same Melbourne International Film Festival in a different packed theatre. Not only that, we had a Q&A after the first and second premiere. So we actually walked on stage and we sat and answered questions to an audience who really wanted to know, obviously, how we're doing. And a few people have commented to me that I looked dissociated and I spoke without much emotion when I gave that first Q&A. And I think it's because it was so confronting. And everyone that watched it walked out feeling the same way, like almost like shell-shocked. And someone came up to me after the first premiere. They whispered in my ear and they said, you're saving many lives and you don't even realize that. It's just like that little tiny moment made it all seem 100% worth it. Not that it didn't beforehand, but that's why we decided to step into this space and allow ourselves to be filmed at the most vulnerable moments, to put visuals and words to that so that more people might understand, feel validated, or feel empathetic for others who have gone through that. And then, surprisingly, another film festival, they wanted to quickly get some screenings in before it premiered on the streaming platform called Stan. Stan is a streaming platform in Australia only for Australia. So we had three screenings on one day with this film festival. And it was very, very full on, but it was a beautiful opportunity for more people to come and see this and hear from us versus just having it on the streaming platform. And then a whole week of media started. Every day, photo shoots, interviews, discussions, and different articles were dropped every single day and podcasts leading up to the big release on Stan, which was on October 5th. And we were very fortunate. Our documentary was the number one spot on the streaming platform for at least 5 or 6 days, which is very unusual for a documentary. So that was really powerful, the support that we felt from the general public in Australia watching our documentary. It remained on the trending list for a really long time as well. So that showed that it was still being watched and we felt, again, that support. The comments online were most of the time supportive. Even someone made a comment on a social that our stories are not for entertainment. And my response was, no, it's really not for entertainment. It's to educate. It's to raise awareness. It's to validate other survivors. It's to put words and action and visuals to things that people do not see and won't understand unless they do. And I hope that it doesn't just stay in Australia. I hope it goes everywhere in the world because I think it can provide a lot of context, a lot of education, a lot of awareness. We've been asked this question many times, how we get through stuff. We really rely on each other. We can be a bit goofy. We can laugh about something. I'll always be the one bringing food and snacks and making sure that everyone's well looked after in that regard. We kind of step into these roles of being there for each other because we are going through it together. We've grown in our relationship to not just be trauma bonded or just because we've been through so much from our very, very early childhood, but we've actually grown to really respect each other's strengths and really give to each other what needs to be given at that moment.
I love that. Have you been connected through this process with any specific resources or nonprofits that you'd like to suggest?
The organization that I have aligned myself with and have recently become a board member of is National Survivors Foundation. They were formerly called In Good Faith Foundation. They just recently renamed themselves as National Survivors Foundation. They do a tremendous amount of really good work with survivors. They have social workers on the team. They have resources and referencing. Through them, so many survivors have felt validated that there is a day on the calendar to recognize all survivors of abuse. And it's something that I've spread the word about a lot as well, because even many Australians don't know that that day is set in the calendar. Another organization that my sister and I are ambassadors for is Loud Fence, which is quite specific to Australia.
Thank you for sharing about those. What legal change would you specifically like to see happen to better support victims in the future?
Firstly and foremost, judges need to be accountable to someone, and it has to be transparent. I want to see a transparent understanding of where judges go to get feedback, how they know that how they are serving in such a powerful position is the right position for them to be in, particularly when it comes to sexual abuse cases. Because not just in my case, but in many cases, judges have said some really awful things to victims. I myself would be happy to sit in a room with judges and give them some trauma-informed training. And it doesn't have to be complicated, but just bring back in that human ability to understand they're sitting up there, the victim is down there, and things they say are so impactful to victims for years after. Second, victims need to have more rights in the court systems. When a victim survivor goes through the legal system, there are so many rights given to the perpetrator, and it always feels like the balance is just not fair. And the third one, probably again, regarding to the legal reform, is that character references, and I know that's being worked on in Australia, but it's not, I think, fast enough. Character references should not be allowed for the perpetrators. Because in, let's say, the case of Marco Leifa, the character reference describing her warmth and her care was exactly the method she employed to abuse. I've been asked this question, would you go through the process again? And my answer is absolutely yes. Because going to court, no matter how difficult it was for me, and I know it is for others, what I feel, it brings accountability to the perpetrator, regardless even of the outcome. And I know that us going to court and bringing perpetrators to account is helping the world be a safer place.
Thank you so much for everything you've given us, the information, the time, the energy. Thank you for your advocacy work and everything you continue to do. You are amazing.
And thank you for the opportunity to share on your podcast.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
The beginning of sophomore year of high school, this girl came up to me and said, there is someone in the same science class and the same French class, and he wants your number. He began immediately with the phone calls. He would leave notes in my locker. He would leave flowers on my desk when I walked into a classroom. One of the things that was very consistent, even from high school, he was an incredibly jealous person. We hadn't even finished college yet. He was hyper-focused on having a baby. I was 21 years old. He would even suggest we go to a fertility doctor. I do think it was a way to trap me, to make sure that I never left him.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.